Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Thanks for bearing with me yesterday. I don't know what the deal is. I think it's me, though. I think I have not enough understanding of technology. So, but everything seems to be good today. And it was my goal this week to discuss many of the issues that we brought up in the year 2014. It was quite a walk down memory lane, looking through my folder and remembering all the stories that we talked about all year. Some good, some not so good. One of the things that did catch my eye, though, that I thought we would spend a few minutes on today was how many of our pretty much iconic movie stars we lost this year, or entertainers, I guess I should say. Let me bring Shelley in, because there's so much to talk about, I'm afraid we'll run out of time. We will not be on the air on Thursday, and missing yesterday, so we only have Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday to kind of catch up. Good morning, Shelley.
Well, good morning, Rainey.
How you doing, honey?
I'm doing pretty good.
That's good. Well,
so
as I said,
issues are resolved, huh?
Yeah, it was everything, though. Absolutely everything was messed up. It took me almost 4 hours on the phone with various entities.
Wow.
Thank God. You know, it's kind of convoluted, though, here in Lake Worth, because you don't have just one company. It's a married situation with AT&T and DirecTV. And when I first signed on for this, it's all about, yes, we're one team. AT&T bought DirecTV, but still doesn't work like that. So one hand doesn't know what the other one is doing. So I'm calling saying I don't have television and phone and computer, and AT&T is telling me, well, we don't have anything to do with the television, and it shows that you're up and running. And I said, but I'm not. So it was quite a fiasco. And I had to get a little bit, you know me, I'm not very often rude, but I did have to get a little bit short, because they would even drop my call. They're in that business, and they would drop my call.
I was going through the same thing when I was with Bond originally, because I had my internet, my phone, the voice over IP, and I would have internet, and I would have no phone. And then they would say, well, it's because your connectivity with Comcast is all screwed up. And then I call Comcast, and they say, well, no, it's because Vonage signal is too weak or something stupid like that. And I was like, so that's why I finally just got rid of Vonage and went with Comcast. I mean, Vonage is a great savings, but it wouldn't work with Comcast. It wasn't like a clean connection between the two of them. So it was a little frustrating.
No, and I, the same thing happened to me with the same two companies. And what I picked up on was it became an opportunity for them to point their fingers in another direction and not accept responsibility. Geez, when have we talked about that before? Every day, maybe?
Yep. So, yes, that was frustrating, and I finally, I finally gave into it. But like you said, there are areas in the United States where you can't get these bundled packages. If you can get them, they're better, because then you can't have the finger point thing. It's one service provider, and they got to figure out what's going on. But when as soon as you have more than one service provider, it does kind of give them an out, which is not a nice thing, but that's what happens.
So what I did actually before yesterday was I went through, we lost 53 entertainers this year. And I didn't want to go through and name them all, but some I think everybody will know when I say their names. And I just want to say about everybody that I'm going to mention, obviously I'm the one who chose them, so they touched my life at some point in time for one reason or another. A few of them that they put on this page I never even heard of. Be that what it may, or be that whatever it is probably because I wasn't interested in something that they were doing. I mean, some couple were like producers and things like that I never heard of. And there was a couple people that I think I'd seen their face before, but I wouldn't have been able to tell you their names. So I chose people that I hope everybody will know, but I'd like to mention them because it's amazing how you'll be going along and somebody will say, whatever happened to so-and-so? And somebody mm-hmm. in the crowd will say, well, I think they passed away. Oh, no, I don't think they did. And there's always, you know, because you still see them, you know, because their lives go on forever in
right.
television
right.
and movies. They go on forever. So it is hard to know who is really gone and who isn't really gone. So the one that touched me the most, of course, this year, and we talked about him at length, was Robin Williams.
Yep, absolutely.
I think Robin Williams gave the world more than he ever got back. And when I see pictures of him, the pictures that they show of him are always so varied. I mean, some with beards, some with him as Mork, some with him as, you know, a very young man, very trim and healthy-looking, shiny-faced, and then others are maybe darker times in his life. We know now that, of course, he suffered from tremendous depression, which, of course, we discussed on the one show that we talked about him at length, that it often happens that people who choose to make other people laugh have difficulty laughing themselves. So that was something that, and there's a couple other people on the list that I think perhaps suffered the same thing. One of them is Mickey Rooney. Mickey Rooney, of course, considerably older than Robin Williams, was another person who brought a lot of joy. His life was tumultuous, to say the least. But he was one who enjoyed doing antics and things like that to make other people laugh. And even though there's no, that I've ever seen, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I've never seen anything that talks about him having any kind of depression problems and stuff like that, but he certainly was never happily married. I mean, the man married, I don't know how many times, 13 or 14 times, some outrageous amount of people. Sometimes he remarried somebody else and has all kinds of children, and so that kind of sounds like somebody who's in search of something as well, don't you think?
He passed on in 2014?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I didn't realize
yep.
that.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh, yeah.
One of the things I'd like to say about Robin Williams real quick before we continue is that I had noticed I think it was People magazine, I'm almost pretty sure about that, and it was so nice to see the front page of the magazine say, Robin Williams and his legacy of love. And there's an article inside where they interviewed his son. And it's a very positive article. And it's like, and that's what I'm talking about. What, you know, his death was such a tragedy for all of us. And then it's almost like we got a double hit because of how the media was portraying him. And it was very uplifting to see that one of the magazines wasn't covering the dark side, but was covering the legacy he left behind. And isn't that really the importance of people?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I got bits and pieces of that, too, because I have a People magazine site that I go to because they're always telling stories about what's going on and things like that. They're a good magazine, I think. So I saw clips of the story that you're talking about, and it was warm and beautiful, and of course, embraced the person who spent his life trying to make other people entertained, which isn't easy sometimes. And of course, Joan Rivers, who had a very cutting edge type of comedy, and brought herself to to heights that were almost iconic. She was a part of a lot of different things in Hollywood and in the entertainment field. And what we know now is her death was almost accidental, something that the surgeons did or didn't did or something. So that was kind of sad. And then Elaine Stitch. Do you know who Elaine Stitch is, Shel?
I recognize the name, and I don't know why.
Well, she was statuesque, is that a word, woman, very strong voice. She was on a lot of shows. I can't remember, like, her claim to fame kind of movie, but she was always the very strong older woman who said what she felt like saying, and she was on some of the comedy shows in later years.
I know the name, and the minute, if I Google her, I'll say, oh, of course, because I know I recognize the name. I'm just not putting a face to it.
Yep. And I loved her. I thought she was a perfect personification of a very strong, I'll listen, but you're not going to bullshit me kind of woman. You know, I really, really liked her. And, of course, one of my all-time favorites, James Garner. Loved James Garner. Always likened James Garner to my own husband. They always had similar looks, and I thought that was sad. And one of the Everly brothers, Phil Everly, passed away this year. And another actor whose claim to fame wasn't his looks or anything like that. He always played kind of off-the-wall parts, but a very interesting character, I believed, was Philip Seymour Hoffman. And he also had a very strange personal life that was under the looking glass more often than it should have been, I think. But I thought he was an amazing actor. Lauren Bacall. Lauren Bacall has been a... Go ahead, honey.
Now, I'm saying that Philip Seymour Hoffman, you know, he was in a lot of really iconic movies. And when you look at his repertoire, you know, he never really played the leading man. He always played one of the supporting characters, but he's always a strong supporting character. And it's, he really played some diversified roles. It's like, I mean, when you look at his repertoire of movies, it's quite impressive.
Mm-hmm. I always thought so, too. And he wasn't a pretty boy, and he wasn't, he had a great voice. But not a pretty boy, but still kind of like an everyday kind of guy. So I agree, and I don't think I ever saw anything that I didn't enjoy him in. Lauren Bacall, who was an older actress back in the, you know, the heyday of Hollywood, she was very, very popular. Another one who I'm sure you'll know who he is, but for those that don't, he was in a lot of the spaghetti westerns with Clint Eastwood, and that's Eli Wallach. Do you remember Eli Wallach?
Of course. Uh-huh.
Yep. And he passed away this year. And I thought he was another one of those kind of, I guess they call them bit actors, although that always sounds like it's not a compliment. But actors like Eli Wallach and Elaine Stitch, and some of the other ones that we're going to touch on today weren't always the leading man or woman in a movie, but their talent seemed to support in the movies that made it big, supported the one who was put out there face front to be the actual star of any movie. And I can't imagine if I were an actor and I was going to be in a movie, I would want the people who lent their talent to mine. And that's the way I felt about Elaine Stitch and Eli Wallach. And there's a couple others here that I'm going to read that I believe did the same thing for a lot of the actors that made it just a little bit bigger and had really major starring roles. So another one of those people is Bob Hoskins. Now, I think he had a couple leading roles, but they weren't grandiose. But he often was the little funny guy that would lose his temper and things like that. You know who he is, I'm sure.
Isn't Bob Hoskins the one who played the detective in Roger Rabbit?
Yep, Yep, that's exactly who he is. I think that was his only major role. All the rest of them, it seems like he was in the one with Cher and Winona Ryder too, as the love interest of Cher. The Mermaids or something like that was the name of that movie. Do you remember that?
Cher, yeah,
remember
the mother
movie. And Winona Ryder.
Yeah, but I know that Bob Hoskins has been in a lot of movies, and you're right, and he a lot of times he's not playing the leading role, but there have been a few movies where he has been. I think he was in The Lord of the Rings also. I think he played the Bilbo character. I'm not sure if that was Bob Hoskins, but I always thought it was. But, you know, they have them all made up, but I always thought that was him.
I haven't, as a rule, really sat and watched all those. I know there's some favorites of yours, but I think I know the character that you're talking about, and I think you're right. I don't know that for a fact, but I do think you're right. Oh, my goodness. The lady next door must be walking her dog. another old-time actor who was funny and had his own show many, many years ago was Sid Caesar. And I felt bad when Sid Caesar passed away, I think because he was reminiscent of my childhood, watching Sid Caesar and Imogene Coco on variety television with my grandparents way back in the day. He was a funny man, didn't do a whole lot other than that. And I was kind of surprised to see that we just lost him this year because I thought he was gone before.
Oh, wow.
Do you remember Sid Caesar, honey?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, a childhood star who went on to politics. But as a child, she's probably the most famous child star. I would think, somebody might argue that point with me, irrelevant, but I think she is, and that's Shirley Temple. Shirley Temple made hundreds of movies as a very, very young child and was incredibly talented and precocious and beautiful and all of the above. And she was in some movies with some very famous people as well. Of course, that's back in the 50s. So that's a long time ago, but she passed away this year. I believe her.
She never went into movies as an adult, did she? When she became an adult, she went into politics. I don't know of any movie with her in it as an adult.
I think there was a couple when she was like maybe 19, 20, but they didn't go anywhere, and she wasn't in the leading role or anything. But she was still very cute then, and then all of a sudden she married Black, I don't remember, John Black like that his name was, and then she got involved in the politics with him. But she was another very interesting character and made it to quite a ripe old age. She was in her 80s, late 80s, I believe. And then Casey Kasem. Do you remember who Casey Kasem is?
Oh, yeah. I grew up with Casey Kasem.
And
the Saturday morning countdown, and I mean, that's going back 20 years ago when I lived in New York, actually 30 years ago. And when I was was young, I used to watch that every Saturday. It would be the first thing to go up on my TV, and it would run for a couple of hours, and they'd go through all the top hits of the week.
Yeah, yeah. I loved Casey Kasem. I loved his voice.
Mm-hmm.
His voice was always so totally recognizable. I always thought that was kind of cool that he had that different voice. And, of course, another one of his, things as he... Yeah, we already talked about him, honey. Spike just stuck his head in my office door and said, "Don't forget James Garner." And Casey Kasem married that, I think she was Swedish, that big, big, tall woman who was
I was just saying, he had like a Sonny and Cher type of marriage where he married this beautiful blonde woman. And, yeah, I remember that. I didn't remember her name, but I could see her in my mind's eye because I remember they did together.
Yeah, and I think that was one of his claims to fame as well, because they stayed happily married, so far as I know, their whole lives. I think she's still with us. And then, of course, there's Pete Seeger, who's, if you were around in the 70s, you know who Pete Seeger is, and he passed away this year. And then another one who I think taught us all a lot and who gave the world an awful lot was Maya Angelou. And when she passed this year, Facebook and social media was just alive with quotes from Maya Angelou. And you forget how many amazing things she said, and some of her famous quotations I hear people say all the time. I don't know if they know that's where they came from, but I hear them repeated a lot. And she was a very heartwarming, very down-to-earth, forgiving kind of a person. So, as I said, there were 53 of them, and I chose the names that I thought people would be able to connect to and really, you know, really remember them. So it was a year for that, kind of a sad year in that respect. So I want to bounce, though, from that, because there's so many things I found out that I wanted to talk about for the end of the year. Do you remember the week that we spent, actually, and it blossomed into more shows about mental illness? And Shelley and I both went to a couple of them, and Shelley came to the grand finale with me over here in Palm Beach at one of the local hotels for Palm Beach Mental Health Week. And we watched a video that yours truly was lucky enough to be invited to be in, and where I talked about Michael and I talked about being kinder to one another. But we learned a lot about the revolving door in the world of mental illness. And ironically, one of the shows I'm preparing for in the weeks to come is a new program that is being put out there to help. It's actually sponsored by our president, Barack Obama, and he's trying to figure out a way to get a lot of the institutionalized people, young people, old people, that have been diagnosed with some kind of an issue, either mental illness or retardation, or maybe even all of the above, that are institutionalized, in a safe home of some kind where they're cared for, which is very expensive to operate, and always gets, you know, not such a great reputation for various reasons. So he's introduced a program that will transition these people. So one of the things that Shelley and I learned when we went to the seminars was mental illness plays a big role in the relationship between our law enforcement, our DCF, which is Department of Children and Family, and our mental health advocates, psychiatrists, psychologists, all the people that are immersed in government-funded arenas. Now, you take a young person who, for many different reasons, the saddest, of course, is that nobody that was supposed to love them and care for them the rest of their life doesn't know what to do with them, so they end up on the street. And they may be under the tutelage of DCF, which has more of a job than it can obviously handle. So they're in the street. They might live in a halfway house. They might live in a group home, which are popping up all over in Florida. There's neighborhoods in Deerfield right now that you can drive through, old neighborhoods in Deerfield and Old Pompano, the Highlands, where you can tell somebody's purchased a property and is using it as a halfway house. And some of them are young people and some of them are elderly people, but they're people that are, for a myriad of reasons, displaced. So what we found out is that even those people that are under the tutelage of a house parent or somebody who's managing the property where they live, they still run out of their meds. They often go off the deep end. They go in search of their own answer, their own comfort zone, and get involved with street drugs. And in many cases, to score street drugs, they do participate in illegal activities. Anything from theft to prostitution is a part of their world. And in one of the seminars I was at, a young woman stood up, and she clearly had on a T-shirt from the Mental Health Association. And she's one of the kids who are there because they need to be there, but she also is working her way through the organization to be of some assistance, not to just accept assistance. She's trying to make a difference. So she stood up and she said, something happens if it's a weird month, or maybe I took, you know, too many of my meds one day, or you never know what could happen. Or something happened and I didn't get over to sign in and get my exam, so now I'm late and I can't get them until they can give me another appointment. A whole bunch of different things can happen to them. When that does happen, she's in trouble, because without the stabilizing meds that she takes, she's not the same person. And that's when problems arise. Then what happens is they end up getting arrested, regardless of who knows them, regardless of who knows what is going on in their life. There's a procedure. Now, we'll talk about that someday too, because I think that's absolutely ridiculous if you know the difference, but it's what's set up. So the procedure says she gets arrested, she gets booked, she gets put in jail. And in the days that she's there, they reevaluate her, give her new meds or the same meds, whatever the doctor that is taking care of her now deems what she should be taking. And then they do a turnaround and they let her out, but she costs the system several hundred dollars for that little 3-day, 5-day visit. And what did it do to her? And what did she do to get herself there? More stuff that damages her personal psyche. So it is a major revolving door, and sad, very, very sad. So there was lots of conversation about what to do and how to manage it with a little bit more, I don't know, respect and understanding without being so lenient that people take advantage of you, a lot like raising your own child. The same issues involved with these young people as there are involved when you love your child and you want to help them. It's often difficult to make the right decisions. So what do you remember about that day when we saw that, or when we sat through that seminar, Shel? What stuck with you?
Well, a couple of things that stuck with me were that one of the things is that sometimes, excuse me, people that get into the system sometimes can't get out effectively, and sometimes people that need to be in the system can't seem to get into it. So there seemed to be too much variation out there as to who gets help, who doesn't get help, and who's making the decisions on how to move people forward. So that was one thing that got my attention. The other thing that got my attention, and this is something we've talked about many times, is that because there is no centralized assistance out there, you can actually spend days, weeks, or even months trying to find the place that would be appropriate for your situation or your loved one's situation, before you find the place that's going to work for you, because these it almost seems like all the different solutions out there don't talk to each other. So you'll go to one center and say, well, no, we can't help you. You have to go to this center on the other side of town. You go over there, you wait in line, you fill out an application, you talk to somebody, well, no, we can't help you. You have to go over here. You know, and then sometimes you're sent back to the first place you started at, and it's, you know, so people get very disheartened. And sometimes it's difficult to know where to go to get the appropriate help. And then, like I said, mm-hmm. sometimes when they do get the help, it's either too much or not enough. They're either kept institutionalized past the point of them needing it, or they can't seem to get into a lockdown environment that they need for various reasons. So those are the two things that really stuck out with me.
Well, and I would say the latter is is the first place, in my opinion, that they should start making the repairs. For instance, there was a lot of talk about CARP. CARP is a local place. It is not really a lockdown, but it's like a like what they called in the old days a drunk tank. You can go there of your own volition, walk in and say, I need help, I'm sick, I can't get clean. Whether it's alcohol or drugs or whatever the case might be, they'll sign you in. If you have any money, you can give it to them. If you don't have any money, they'll take you anyway. They'll keep you usually for, 72 hours is usually the longest term. And there's somebody there who keeps an eye on your blood pressure and your heart rate and stuff like that. So that there's no issues in case you're coming down off of something that is, you can't do it. As for instance, oxycodone. There's a lot of addiction to oxycodone. And oxycodone, if you just try to go cold turkey, the results can be actually deadly. So they help with all of that. There's not a lot of... I've been there many times, and there's not a lot of medicinalness. another one of those made-up words. You don't see a lot of clinical feeling. There is not. That's a better word and easier for me to say. So, but there is, there is people, and there's somebody at the front, and there's somebody in the back, and there's beds and everything, and so it's doing a job. Is it doing the best job? I would say no. Is it doing a job that lends itself to repetition? Yes. And I would say that's the worst part. Now, when I spoke up against CARP in a not a way of condemning, but also not a way of condoning what they do. I just said, instead of spending all the money on CARP, if you need to keep the CARP building, if you need to keep the program, then throw a little bit more money at it and make it more applicable to what it's addressing. And a young woman, beautiful young woman, stood up and said to me, they saved my life. And I said, I know. I heard your talk, and I know who you are, and it's very impressive. But you're one in how many? I believe that people who really, really want to be saved can save themselves, and that's the truth. So you may have been able to do what you did in my back bedroom, and you'd have been fine. But I don't know that CARP, as it sits right now, lends itself to the people who really want to but don't have the energy, don't have the tenacity, don't have the balance that's required to get himself to the other side of that story. So she and I talked afterwards.
Yeah, that's a very interesting comment that you just made, because you hear that all the time, where some people just have incredible success stories at particular centers, and other people get literally no help at all. And that's just like everything else we talk about, even when we talk about holistic healing and things like that.
is that there really is no cookie cutter. There's no cookie cutter solution for problems. Each person has to find their individual path. Now, there are some, you know, it's not like there's millions and millions of solutions, but there could be multiple solutions, there could be dozens of solutions, and you have to keep fighting until you find the one that works for you. And you can't get disheartened because something that worked for somebody else doesn't work for you, because there's never just one solution out there to any problem. And you just have to sometimes be willing to be diligent enough to keep looking until you find the one that finally clicks for you. And sometimes it's working is because you're also not being open-minded or you're not working with it. So sometimes you also have to do some self-evaluation. Am I really working this program the way they're telling me to work it? So there's a couple things. You have to do some self-evaluation, and you also have to not get disheartened if it doesn't work for you the way it works for everybody else.
Well, and I mean, that's true in almost everything we do, isn't it, honey? I mean, isn't that true in relationships? Isn't that true in your job? Sometimes you can be, let's go with rocket scientists, since we won't be hurting anybody we know.
I do know a rocket scientist.
Oh, geez. Well, so you move into that realm with a room full of rocket scientists, and some of them may know everything there is to know about rocket science, but they're not successful because other parts of their lives don't lend them to being able to work through the other stuff that goes with being a rocket scientist. They know the technology. They just don't have the personality or the tenacity to work themselves through such a stressful job. So that's true of recovery, more true than anybody understands. If you have an addictive personality, which most of us do, just different levels of addictions, then a lot of your self-respect, a lot of your fight, a lot of your ability to overcome things has been stomped down, has been tampered with the use of some of the things that you're doing. So I feel like when I talk to people and they tell me that, you know, they've tried this and they've tried that and they've done all this other stuff and that they've brought themselves to a place where they're clean and sober, they'll be talking to me and I'll be watching them, and they're telling me that they got off heroin. I'm going to remember a conversation with a young woman many, many years ago. And right in front of me, she, in the course of about 45 minutes, she probably had 7 shots of tequila.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, this is all she did was dropped one addiction and picked up another. And this is what happens a lot of time. But I think what worries me more about the mental illness aspect is that if people that are supposedly, and I don't even know if there's any such word anymore, and we've talked about this a million times, normal, everything is functioning, all the jets are firing, everything is going the way it's supposed to be going, and they have difficulty once they've become horribly addicted to a drug or sex or gambling or any of the, or overeating, any of the addictions that are out there. But they've got, you know, everything else is good. They struggle with that addiction. We both see that all the time. So what mm-hmm. do you do to somebody who's got mental issues? Either, as I said, there's such a, I don't think there's a name for everything. Remember the show, I want to say it was last March, when I looked through all my notes, and we talked about We talked about all the different categories there is in mental illness and all the names that they have for different issues. And there's like thousands of them, Shell. Thousands.
Well, see, I have a problem with that anyway, because if you read through the DSMO, they actually talk about the, I'm not sure I have that acronym correctly, but it's the encyclopedia, the desktop book that the mental health industry uses to classify mental illnesses. And they have things in there that are not mental illnesses. If somebody's too happy all the time, if somebody's, they give mental disorders to normal everyday emotional attributes. If somebody's shy, that's now a mental illness. If somebody's very, very outgoing, that's now a mental illness. I mean, it's ridiculous. Some of these places that are out there, and there are two extremes to this. There are people that are suffering terribly from some sort of mental illness and do need help, but there are some people that are not suffering from a mental illness and have been slapped with a label that can literally ruin their lives because they're not mentally ill. You know, there's something else going on with them. So you hear stories on both sides of the coin where people suffer, either because they've been misdiagnosed as being mentally ill when they're not, or when they have been diagnosed as being mentally ill, but they can't seem to get the help that they actually need. So there's two problems out there. And one of the problems is that not every single emotion that a human being feels is a mental illness. And if you read that book, it's too pervasive. They put a label on every single emotion. You know, if I'm shy, I'm shy. I'm not mentally ill. If I'm outgoing, I'm outgoing. I'm not mentally ill. And it's getting to be that scary when every single emotion that's detectable now has a label on it.
I agree with that. And I think, matter of fact, I have notes that I looked at last week when I was planning this show, where we talked about the fact, and I have some copies that I printed off the computer of all the, of all the diagnosis and the names for all the different things that they call them. And we even went back in history and talked about insane asylums and the fact that when a young mother, and this happened a lot, in the 20s, would have a stillborn birth and couldn't stop crying and couldn't get up out of bed. And they'd institutionalize her, put her in an insane asylum, often do shock treatments, and they would, that very often is where she spent the duration of her life. And the same with soldiers. Soldiers would come home from a war and be suffering from PTSD. And nobody had a name for that then. And nobody understood why some people could just get past what they'd done and seen and been a part of, and other people could not. And those people, when we examined everything that happened at Willard State Hospital, it came to light that some of their suitcases that they arrived with to be checked into Willard State Hospital would still have their accommodations and their uniforms and all that. One man had the Purple Heart.
Wow.
And his suitcase was in the attic. And his body was buried in an unmarked grave across the street from Willard Hospital, or Willard Insane Asylum is what it was called back in those days. So it's not new. It's not something that we should have a much better handle. And of course, then we talked about, we let the conversation of mental illness go to the young man that walked into, I think it was Sandy Hook, and first killed his mother, then walked into the school and killed all those kids and the principal, and then killed himself. And then we watched an interview with his father who said that's why he left the mother, because he was scared of his own kids. So what the hell?
Yep.
Why didn't somebody talk about that? And a mother who's a teacher, educated woman, obviously, sees his fascination for guns and just with trying to, I don't know, get close to him, maybe? I don't know for sure. But she takes him for lessons and buys him guns. And then he quits talking to her and they only converse via email. Again, what the hell?
Yeah, that should have been a real red flag at that point, and she completely missed the cue. And it's surprising because as a teacher, you'd think that she would have to have some schooling on how to pick up on kids that are in trouble and stuff like that, and here she missed it with her own son. I mean, that would have been an enormous red flag for me. And it's almost like she was in a denial as to how far her son's mental illness really went.
Well, again, you know, but then we want to send the young people into a place where there's no commitment to them by the people that are running it. There's no connection, no love, no. Let me take some of that back. There probably is some commitment to their job. Is there commitment to the individual? That probably is a one-on-one basis. There are some people that you meet that you see are incredibly scarred, and you just fall in love with them, and you want to do everything you can to help them. But even for somebody like me who can be a real pushover when it comes to things like that, I've met some that I want nothing to do with, and that's the truth, because I feel at a loss. And I think to myself, even if I want to, I don't know what it would be, how it would be, what I would do to make a difference. And I have to let go of that. So if you're working in that arena, in that atmosphere of, say, a CARP, just as a for instance, and there's very little of that, what I would call caring. And you're supposed to feel that way about everybody that walks through the door. There's no way everybody feels that way about everybody that walks through the door. Just no way whatsoever because of human nature. So, again, something has to happen in the world of mental health. Mental health also brings me to one of the shows that we did recently, but I'm going to include it because I feel like there's a major connection. And that was the show we did on Zoochosis. And Shelley took the reins on that and taught us a lot about what's going on in the world of animals that are taken out of their natural habitat. Even if someone builds them one that they think is, you know, a close facsimile thereof, the signs that we can see that some of our most magnificent animals in the world are mentally ill and suffering from depression and anxiety and the same kind of things that we suffer from because we're holding them captive. I lost many nights of sleep after Shelley and I talked about this story, and I don't look at a rocking elephant the same way at all because Shelley shared some things that she had learned. Or a pacing tiger. In my uneducated head, I thought the elephants were rocking, pacifying themselves, that they were fine, and that kind of meant they were happy. I thought a tiger who paced in front of the cage was excited because people were coming to see him. I mean, you know, I guess you could say I'm 12 at heart, maybe younger. But now that I know the truth, we were at the Dreher Park Zoo last year with Emily and AJ, Diana and I, and they have some of the most magnificent white tigers that I've ever seen, and the big Bengal tigers that are so enormous, and they're trying to climb up the palm trees. And now I reflect on that and think to myself, were they trying to get out? It doesn't make sense that they'd want to climb up in a palm tree. There's no branch for them to sit in. I just thought they were playing because my mind wanted to think that they were just having fun because that's where I'm the most comfortable. But now
well,
I know
actually,
different.
That might have been the only symptom that's not of stress. My cats climb trees here all the time. It's kind of what they do. It's kind of a nutty thing to watch them. So I think it is kind of a cat thing. So that might be the only behavior that's not stress-induced because I've seen other cats do that. I would think cats in the wild would do that for fun. You know, they climb trees to stretch their legs and that kind of thing.
But a palm tree? Where are they going to go once they get up there? There's no place for
they're
them
not,
to even
they're not climbing it. They're climbing it for exercise, like a jungle gym.
Oh, okay. Well, good.
At least
and
that's
that
what
makes...
both my cats, when I let them out, one of the first things they do is they run to this one particular, it's all torn up, they run to this one particular tree, they shoot all the way to the top, then they stand there with their tails waggling, and then they either jump off from the middle or they scoot back down. It's hilarious to watch them. I actually got dive-bombed one day by Dennis, you know, the black cat, because he was up in the tree and I didn't know it, and here he comes flying out of the tree and he landed on my back. So it's something they do.
Yeah, well, that makes sense to me. So then that's good. But again, you know, it made me, I don't know, kind of connect.
It made you aware now of looking at their different behaviors now and questioning, are they playing or are they experiencing stress? It makes you question.
Yeah, and it makes me, well, it gives me a little bit deeper insight, I guess, which isn't always a good thing. Because sometimes, I mean, I know people who don't have any deep insight and they seem to float through life without any issues. So I'm not sure that's as big a blessing as I would like it to be. Now, so we went from the mental illness and we moved into the zoochosis. And, of course, we've also talked at length about many of the mental issues being induced by substance abuse. And that's a very, very big topic, and we've talked about it at length, not just this past year, but the first year we got involved in this show, because a lot of our crime, a lot of our hate crime, a lot of our, crime of opportunity is often induced by drugs. And a lot of the repercussions from those actions, it's like that major snowball effect. And ultimately, somebody who is abusing specific drugs and does a lot of things that they're ashamed of, they end up in the pit of despair. And often don't ever climb out. So drugs, of course, if you're going to attack or try to wrap your mind around what you could do to make a difference in the world of mental health, they use drugs to equalize people every day. And often it makes a difference, like we talked about in the very beginning. Some people without certain drugs, even growing up with ADHD, they need them. Teachers won't even let some kids in class. And I know this to be true because this happened with my own grandson, so because they can't handle them. So it's a very, very, very all-encompassing octopus, if you will, of far-reaching tentacles that touch all of our lives every single day, abuse of drugs. We need them. We hate them. We have to have them. We'd like to live without them. It's a pretty deep abyss, and I don't know if it will ever be straightened out so that we get the worth of them without all the bad stuff. But it is a major issue, and in a lot of cases, it is the precursor to severe mental illness and depression. So
I strongly believe, while we're on that note, and I know that you have a different opinion than this, but it's my belief because of all my research. I'm trying to get statistics for my book. That's one of the reasons I haven't released it yet. But I firmly believe that the majority of people that are classified with mental illness, including ADHD, by the way, and those childhood attention deficit disorders, do not require any medication and actually are made worse by medication, that you can permanently alter a person's brain function once you get them on that road of using medication, and that in most cases there are other alternatives such as diet, holistic counseling, not counseling, but holistic therapies, like electromagnetic therapies that help to calm the brain's function and things like that, acupuncture and all these different therapies that are non-invasive, that don't mess with the chemistry of the body, but calm the function of the brain. There are so many things that are non-pharmaceutical in nature that can improve attention, that can improve functioning. There have been studies done in the past, I'm going to mention a few of them in my book, where they've gone into mental hospitals. This is why I don't understand why the government doesn't put more research into this. They've gone into mental hospitals, changed the diet, and started using like music and things like that. And the majority, not all, because some are so clinically entrenched in schizophrenia or whatever that it didn't change them, but people that were showing symptoms of schizophrenia that were brought about by lifestyle were completely healed, completely cured. They didn't have a diagnosis of schizophrenia anymore. Their brain function returned to normal without any medication. And like I said, it didn't work on 100% of the patients. Some of them needed to remain there. But even the ones that remained there on medication, they were able to reduce the medication and their symptoms had lessened. Although they still had schizophrenia symptoms, they had lessened. They weren't so severe. They weren't suffering as much. It did make a difference. So that's why I'm adamant about that. I don't believe that children need to take any ADHD medication. I think that it's really harming our youth. I'm very much against it. And I think that there are always other factors as to why a child is hyperactive or acting one way or acting another way. And I know that the schools are actually paid a fee for every child that is then put on a prescription drug. The schools almost push parents into doing it, which is ridiculous. That's not
where
the school's place.
Where did you get the information that the school is paid to insist the child uses
Oh, there's a lot of books. There's a lot of books out there about that. I've read several now, several different authors who say that. One gentleman actually worked within the school industry for a while, and when he left, he was kind of a whistleblower. But there's others. I think I have three different books here that actually talk about it.
But they talk about it, but do they have proof of that?
Well, yeah.
We're going to have to talk about that.
Google this. Google it.
I will. But, I mean, if you've got something, before I go Google crazy, if you've got something that really is something that could be taken into a court of law kind of proof, I would, if you could email that to me so I could see that, I would like that better than me just Googling, because Google up all kinds of information, as we know. So we're almost out of time, but I want to remind everybody that we will be on the air tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow is New Year's Eve day, and I want to talk about resolutions. I want to talk a little bit about some of the other things that happened this year, the Trayvon Martin, the George Zimmerman, the Michael Brown, the NFL domestic abuse, the Ebola scare. There's so many things that happened this year that I'd like to touch on. So I hope you will join us. And if you have any New Year's resolutions, I'd love to hear what they are. So if you want to email them or put them on Facebook, I'd love to hear what they are, and we'll talk about those as well.
That'll
be
fun.
We won't be back Friday. So God bless everybody. Have a great day. Thanks, Shel.
Thanks, Reen. Have a wonderful day, everyone.